Welcome, everyone, to The Beat. I am Ari Melbourne. We begin with breaking news on the Biden agenda. At this moment, we can report Speaker Pelosi is huddling with House Democrats. This is a closed-door meeting, as Democrats have really shifted from projecting confidence about their agenda here and getting it passed to signs of concern that Biden's plans for domestic spending now hang in the balance. Joe Biden is making a historic push to really reshape the safety net. We've covered the outlines of that here. A sweeping, multi-trillion dollar package that Democrats can only pass, everyone knows this part, if they remain united. Meanwhile, Republicans are threatening everything from the default of the United States to a federal government shutdown. Voting is underway on one of those issues in the Senate right now. Republicans have made it clear they will block a bill that would simply fund the federal government while also raising the debt ceiling. Now, few Republicans would claim that either of those would be reasonable outcomes, a default or shutting down the government right now. But the GOP's threat to cause widespread American suffering for its own political agenda, well, that has proven to be a credible threat in Washington. Let me tell you what else is going on. Later this hour, the House will also formally begin debating its trillion-dollar version of the infrastructure plan, the Speaker moving first the votes that were planned on that from today to now, Thursday. And the president today conceding this timeline has been changing.
What is at stake for your agenda and your presidency with what's happening on the Hill this week?
Victory is what's at stake. Well, it may not be by the end of the week. I hope it's by the end of the week.
Hoping for the end of the week, Pelosi and many Democrats are huddling on this right now. Now, the speaker has proven herself over many years to be a master tactician. And let's be clear, though. Even she now concedes the week is not starting out as planned. Now, that is the situation. Then there is the politics. She still has the vast majority of the party with her. And by that, I mean people with a vote on this in Congress, as well as a lot of support for the Democratic agenda across the coalition in the country. Meanwhile, a progressive writer who's been following all of this, Josh Marshall, notes the overall package is supported overwhelmingly by Democrats in both chambers and pretty much across all factions. And yet the standoff remains in Washington with real efforts to get a handful of conservative Democratic senators back on board. So there we are to start the week. And let me say it like this. In many ways, that could just be the whole story. Just keeping track of what's going on in Washington. A lot of news kind of does come down the pike like that. But let me be clear with you before we bring in our experts. That's how it's often covered, but this is about so much more than Washington. Let me tell you how I see it. We have been living through a horrific pandemic that has often asked most of those with the least. We've covered those long lines to get food, the working poor, uprooted from their jobs. Then, when jobs started coming back, it was a lot of working people and the working poor that were first asked to just get back to work, get in the Uber, go back to delivering food before anyone even claimed it was safe. While the people in America with more money got to zoom their way through this national trauma. And then, of course, there are the nurses, the doctors, the first responders, the teachers who continue to deal with risky classrooms today. We didn't just get through this recent period together. We got through it via an economy and a lot of federal policies that don't distribute the burden equally. And then, meanwhile, there's the other context. Amazon and a cadre of billionaires have had banner years during the pandemic while paying record low taxes, as we've reported and as the Biden administration recently emphasized in their push on these bills. Now, $1 trillion is certainly a lot of money. It's always a lot. And this is a democracy, so people should debate whether they want to spend that much and whether it's worth it. And I'm not here to tell you how to make up your mind on that or how Congress should make up its set of minds. But I will tell you the evidence here stacks up against a lot of hardship. And the president here is basically making an argument, asking people not to focus on counting one or two votes in Washington, although that's part of the process, but arguing that this spending would just make today's America a little bit more fair, that it's worth the cost. And he's betting that argument, spending today, as the recession, the pandemic continues, is a better bet than what the other side seems to be offering, which is delay, obstruction, or accepting more of the status quo. With all that in mind, widening a little bit beyond the Washington lens, we bring in our experts, one of whom was just quoted, editor and publisher of Talking Points Memo, Josh Marshall, and Democratic strategist, analyst, and our friend, Juanita Tolliver. Good to see both of you. Josh, I'll begin with you. As one of the analysts we quoted, looking at a standoff that you argue isn't really left versus center left or left versus moderate, you write that a lot of evidence shows it is the vast march of the Democratic Party, its coalitions and members, and then one or two senators on the other holdout.
Yeah, I mean, that's demonstrably what is the case. One of the most remarkable things about the way that 2021 has developed has been just how united the Democratic Party is on a pretty big, pretty ambitious agenda. You know, there are quibbles here and there, but basically, this is the president's plan. This is the president's agenda. We're now operating with this $3.5 trillion number, which is the sort of the Senate's spin on that agenda. And basically, you know, a lot of emphasis is being placed on the progressives in the House. But again, this is the president's agenda. President Joe Biden, he's not Bernie Sanders. He was not the left candidate going in the Democratic primaries. It's his agenda. And again, basically, he's got the right and the left and the center of the party, all the big factions on board with this. Again, some quibbling at the margins, but not a lot. And it really comes down to these two senators. And the reality is they only have 50 votes, 51 with the vice president. So they've got to get those two on board. But one of the basic things that we've seen in the coverage is that, again, this keeps getting portrayed, you know, as sort of, you know, AOC versus Joe Manchin, or, you know, the progressives and the moderates. But it really is a surprisingly unified Democratic Party with two Senate holdouts. And one of the challenges for the Democrats is that they haven't even really said what they're holding out about. They haven't said, okay, I'm on board with all this stuff, but you got to take this dollar amount down, or you got to get rid of that one program. It's basically just this kind of, you know, moving target of, I'm just not ready yet. It's too much. It's this, it's that, or the other. And that's made it a big challenge, but it really is basically the entire Democratic Party, and in this context, I mean, elected members of Congress. I think it's probably the same in the country as a whole, but elected members of Congress and these two holdouts. And you've also got about maybe a dozen in the House, but it's really the two Senate holdouts. They're the ones who can really bring this all down.
Yeah. And Juanita, against that, you have McConnell basically just saying, as usual, he'll burn the place down. Here he was on the debt ceiling.
We will not provide Republican votes for raising the debt limit. There's no chance Republicans will help lift Democrats' credit limit so they can immediately steamroll through a socialist binge that will hurt families.
Juanita?
It's just really irresponsible, Ari, and completely flies in the face of everything McConnell has said every other time the debt ceiling needed to be raised, and those three times that Democrats voted with Republicans to get it done on a bipartisan basis under the previous president. It's just so irresponsible. I'm frustrated to hear it, but here's the other thing. I'm not the only one who's frustrated to hear him talk like that. Voters, according to a Morning Consult poll released earlier today, said they will blame both parties if the U.S. defaults on its debt or if the government shuts down. So for McConnell and Republicans to think they can get out of this unscathed by filibustering the raising the debt limit is ridiculous. And as Representative Debbie Dingell said, this ain't the time to create drama in people's lives. We are in the middle of a pandemic. And so this move from Republicans is complete BS, Ari.
There you have it, put very strongly, but I understand where you're coming from. Can you speak to that, Josh, this portrayal of Mitch McConnell as that friend where every time you go to brunch with them, there's all this chaos and drama? And even if you want to be sympathetic, at a certain point, you say, you know what, David or Julie, or in this case, Mitch, it sounds like maybe you're the drama. It's not, I mean, I get that you feel upset, but maybe you're the one creating it, because you either take him at his word that he would use his power to default the U.S. over what? I mean, they don't even have a claim here, really, just over the normal disagreement of policy. Or you take it as him, as I mentioned in the lead, just using the economy and the recent hardship we've all gone through, and some, as I emphasize, harder than others, as one more piece of leverage.
Well, you know, Juanita said something really important, and that's the F word, filibuster. It doesn't get mentioned enough in this public discussion. When you see it come up, it's like, oh, the Democrats have another challenge. They need to deal with something called the debt ceiling. What is the debt ceiling? No one knows. You know, no one outside of D.C. has any idea, or really should have any idea, what this term even means. And but that is what is happening. Republicans are saying Democrats got to do this on their own. We're not going to help. This is, you know, it's on you. And in fact, what the Democrats are trying to do is do it on their own. Republicans are filibustering that. They're using the filibuster to drive the country into a debt default. And that is forcing the Democrats to basically pry this into their completely unrelated reconciliation bill. It has nothing to do with it, but that's the only option they have. The thing, what McConnell just said there about, we're not going to let you kind of, you know, add more debt for your socialist agenda and all this stuff. People need to understand what the debt ceiling is about. It's a really stupid thing that it even exists. Think of it in your own life. If you buy something on your credit card, later on, you have to pay your credit card bill. That's all one thing. It's not two separate things. What this debt ceiling thing does is we've already bought the stuff. And now we're deciding, well, should we pay the credit card bill? In the real world, that's all one decision. And that's really what this is about. It's not adding to anything. It's just, are you going to pay the bill for what you already bought? And again, in the real world, it's the answer to that is always yes, unless you want your credit rating destroyed, which is what they're talking about doing for the whole United States.
Right. And I think this goes to, I guess, one of the emergent themes tonight as we talk, which is the difference between Washington and everywhere else in reality. And if you're not versed on the jargon, why would you be? Debt ceiling, it almost sounds like, oh, somebody's going to do some renovations. In fact, it's just a question about whether Republicans are actually going to make good on a threat to try to turn the U.S. into a deadbeat nation, something they only are interested in doing when there are Democratic presidents. And again, we can all be cynical about politics, but I would remind viewers that pre the Obama era, both parties did their work on this, even when different parties controlled the White House, to try to get to solutions. So this is an asymmetric development. It started with the backlash to Obama, and we all know how that looked and how that led to the Trump era. And that's been the modern GOP MO. Moving beyond the ceiling and the renovations, Josh, I also wanted to ask you about a really scorching letter from progressives that I think speaks to a lot of where this debate is headed and is important for this week. And really the spending that, as I've emphasized, could make a dent in some of the hardship in America right now. They go after these conservative Dems who are holding out. And they take issue with even the, quote, moderate label, saying what they're really trying to do is derail popular policies of what is a moderate president in Biden. Conservative Democrats in the House and Senate have sought to delay, oppose, or water down this Build Back Better Act, they write. And then they really go in for the kill here, Josh, and they say weak Democrats are committing political malpractice. Progressives have learned the right lessons. What do you think about that in the balance of power in a party where Obama and Biden both position themselves as fundamentally compromising center-left figures, not far-left? And here you have the compromise emanating from the White House. And then you have these few Democrats, what the progressives are calling quote-unquote weak Democrats, saying, well, no, it's not moderate unless we get on board, which is news to a lot of Democratic primary voters who, as you and Juanita were just pointing out, said, well, they actually picked the moderate. They already have a moderate in charge. This is his moderate compromise plan.
Yeah, I think the key is that the real tell here is that Manchin and Sinema, especially Sinema, but Manchin, they have not really made a point to say this program is too extreme. This program's too liberal, it spends too much, whatever like that. And that really tells you what is going on here. They don't really have disagreements on the merits. Their effort is a positioning one. It's an optics one. They want to define themselves as moderate by saying no to their own party. So what their own party is saying, is pushing for, is kind of irrelevant. Whatever the rest of the Democratic Party puts forward, they are going to want to say, no, I can't do that because I'm moderate. I'm not extreme. You're extreme. So this is kind of one of the things that hasn't come through in the reporting. It's not just that there's really not a disagreement over policy. You have most of the Democratic Party talking the language of policy. Here's the things that we think are important. Here's the money we want to spend. These two senators, they are talking the language of positioning. And it's that conflict between the two. It's not about the programs. These two senators have decided that they are going to earn their DC reputation as moderates, not the extreme people, by just saying no to their own party. And that's really what this is about. It's not even about the policy. They're not paying attention to the policy.
I think that's fair. And that's I think, what has been really revealed in the moving target or Manchin's call for a pause. And there's a lot on the line here. So if it's all about positioning, you know, save it for yoga class and get to work on getting a bill through, because there's a lot going on in the country that people need some help with. Josh and Juanita, thank you both for kicking us off. I want to tell everyone what we have coming up. Fact checking some of the new claims about the big lie as subpoenas pile in from the January 6th committee. Neil Katyal is here on all of the legal landscape. And later, we're going inside the Matt Gaetz legal fight in that criminal sex trafficking probe. Plus, a very special guest tonight. You know his name. You know his work. The iconic Washington journalist, Bob Woodward. We're going to get into everything. A special guest tonight on The Beat. Stay with us.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Trump and many of his MAGA fans are having trouble with their own fake audits that they've demanded while they're ramping up attacks on democracy. Take a look in Georgia, where Trump is actually under an ongoing criminal investigation.
We won on the Arizona forensic audit yesterday at a level that you wouldn't believe. It is clear in Arizona that they must decertify the election. It was a corrupt election. And it's my opinion, by the way, that Georgia is far worse.
You may be feeling like you're having flashbacks there. Donald Trump speaking to a crowd with all of the usual pageantry. This was this weekend, and this is part of what this MAGA movement has become. Calls to decertify elections, even when their own sham audits, which aren't valid and wouldn't change the outcome anyway, actually found that Trump lost by even more than he thought. New York Times reporting Trump and his allies are fomenting more and more conspiracy theories. A Washington Post probe, meanwhile, shows an election supervisor in Colorado accused of sneaking someone into county offices to copy voting system hard drives. This is not a drill. It requires scrutiny to be ahead of whatever they may be cooking up. Republican Congresswoman Cheney, who, of course, was ousted from leadership over confronting Trump's big lie, is saying, pay attention because this person, who may run again for president, is dangerous.
I watched while the attack was underway, understood very clearly what he did on January 6th, what he failed to do on January 6th. Instead of stopping the attack while it was underway, he was busy calling up senators, trying to get them to delay the count. So there was no calculation.
I think he's very dangerous.
That is an insider, a conservative Republican, speaking in depth about what she views as the sloppy coup that Trump continued to try to execute on January 6th amidst the crime spree at the Capitol. Meanwhile, the Times is reporting that the FBI had an informant during the insurrection, a member of the Proud Boys who was reportedly texting his own FBI handler during that fateful insurrection, but maintaining they had no plans to enter the Capitol itself. Meanwhile, Speaker Pelosi's investigative committee trying to get to the bottom of it all. Last week, there was news of a major win for Congress. You may recall we were covering this. Biden's administration said from the lectern, the White House press secretary, that he would not use executive privilege to shield Donald Trump with the release of information or evidence relating to the January 6th insurrection. So that felt like a big deal when it comes on the record from the lectern. But this is interesting, and this happens, of course, on many stories, including out of Washington. The Biden administration is now appearing to walk back that fairly straightforward statement. It is saying something that sounds much more lawyerly, that decisions about whether or not to shield evidence and documents will actually be made on a, quote, case-by-case basis. Well, what's up with those cases? We have someone who has handled some of the most high-profile cases for President Obama and others in the nation. former acting Solicitor General Neil Kotchall with the answers after 60 seconds. We'll be right back. I'm joined now by former acting U.S. Solicitor General Neil Kotchall. Much to get into, but I want to begin with where we left off late last week. Everyone's had their time and their weekends. It seemed like a major development from the White House lectern spurning executive privilege claims by Donald Trump if he tries to make them around January 6th. Now we're told case by case. Enlighten us. Break it down both. What does that mean and what do you think's happening here at the intersection of Washington law and policy, which you lived?
Great to see you, Ari. It's been a while. I'm really glad to be back. So executive privilege is this idea that basically there's a zone of secrecy around the president and presidential decision making that protects information. And so what the Biden administration last week said was, well, with respect to January 6th, we're going to let these White House officials be subpoenaed, testify in front of Congress and the like. Now, today, I don't think they've walked it back. I think they've just said they're going to evaluate things on a case-by-case basis. I think that's actually the standard long-term Justice Department position. Here's why. Because suppose you have a president, like a normal president, who actually like does work. Even if you have something like an insurrection happening on January 6th, maybe there's like some foreign policy negotiation happening at the same time or something like that that you don't want disclosed. And so it's fully appropriate, at least for presidents who do work or normal, that you'd want to have not a blanket executive privilege waiver, but something that's case by case. And that's all I think today.
Let me press you on that a little bit, because I hear what you're saying. It makes sense. The case-by-case framework, though, is we're talking about the case of the January 6th insurrection. We didn't read or report Jen Psaki saying that there would never be a possible situation where something that the previous president did would be entitled to this. But on this probe with this January 6th committee, she seemed to imply they weren't going to honor it, then walked it back. So if it's case-by-case and she says on this case they weren't going to honor it and now they're kind of pulling back from that, it feels like they may still leave room to not fork over stuff around this case.
And Ari, what I'm saying is I think by case by case, I don't think I mean the case of January 6th as much as the micro details about any specific incident on January 6th. And it's at least conceivable to me that in setting policy, you wouldn't want to say, hey, maybe there's some secret negotiation that's happening at the same time or something like that. Maybe that little piece shouldn't be disclosed. But absolutely, I'm agreeing with you 100%. If the Biden administration walked back, letting the American public and the Congress know what's happening on January 6th, I will have a conniption. I mean, because that, you know, there's nothing more important than getting to the bottom of the truth. And I take it that the White House is on the same page there.
And you're known for your measured analysis and not for conniptions. So that shows people if you're going to get to a Kotchall conniption, that would be quite a development. You're warning us to sit it out and make sure we see where this ultimately lands, which is, of course, I think a fair point as well, as we're following, everyone's following quite closely what comes out of the White House on that. I want to switch gears, but a similar topic, play you something that Steve Schmidt said when he was talking to Rachel about what we're seeing here is this building chorus of attacks on the 2020 election results. And it's gotten more and more absurd, which on the one hand can make you feel dismissive, like, leave it alone, why even bring it up? But on the other hand, is sort of normalizing and routinizing this endless relitigation to a degree that is if elections aren't really resolved. It kind of just depends on what people feel or what their own political audits say. And he made a point about why he thinks this is happening. Take a listen.
The Republican Party of late September 2021 is a profoundly more radical party than it was on Election Day, than it was on January 6th, than it was on Inauguration Day. They are driving both chaos at the same time where they are selling order.
Your reaction?
Yeah, so I agree with Schmidt that, it's dangerous. And also, these things are inaccurate by the Republicans. I mean, totally. I mean, first of all, wasn't Trump supposed to be reinstated by August or something? That's what he said. And he's had more delays than, like, the Postal Service under Louis DeJoy. I mean, Republicans first predicted that Donald Trump would win, then that the Supreme Court was going to intervene on his behalf, then that Biden would last 10 days, then he was supposed to return on March 4th and the like. I mean, I've had more fakeouts than Major League Baseball. It's ridiculous. So I think one part is just the inaccuracy. It is just a complete, total lie. Then the other part Schmidt cites citing is the danger. I mean, this Arizona recount, what a waste of money. They spent thousands and thousands of dollars, and it turned out at the end of it, even after they hired like a biased Republican-leaning conspiracy firm to do the recount, that Biden got more votes under the recount than Trump did, more than the initial count. And here's what I think the danger is. It's that these kinds of insinuations about elections are proliferating. And so you've had recounts demanded and trying to get voter records in Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, in Texas, and all sorts of places that undermine our faith in the election system. And this is not about, you know, looking back. This is about Republicans looking forward and saying, you know, in the next time, can they sow that kind of doubt and maybe just turn a few people's votes, a few key people, and then hand the election to the Republicans, even though they wouldn't have won it in a democracy. And what Schmidt's saying is right. We don't have a Republican Party that's an anti-Democrat party. The Republican Party has become an anti-democracy party.
Yeah, that's an important and chilling point, which people like Steve Schmidt, who worked at the highest levels of the Republican Party, and people like yourself, who have a legal lens, are really warning the nation about what people want to do about that. And that's against the backdrop of a bunch of races to be the top elections official that we've covered that have now partisan Republican candidates running basically in the mode of the big lie. And what does that mean? So it's a lot to keep an eye on. Neil, good to have you back here. I want to remind everyone, you can always go to MSNBC.com/openingarguments, where we actually host a page where you can just find Neil's analysis, this segment, and also past election segments that are great tutorials. So a reminder about that. I want to turn to some other legal news tonight, and it is significant. The very famous singer R. Kelly convicted today after a 7-week, very serious sex trafficking trial with a host of allegations. He now faces up to life in prison. He was convicted today on all counts. And that includes serious felonies like racketeering and violating an interstate anti-sex trafficking law that's designed to protect potential victims. Prosecutors had accused the singer of being a, quote, serial sexual predator who abused young women as well as underage girls and boys for over 2 decades. The New York Times reports Kelly sat motionless as this guilty verdict was read today, his defense attorney saying he was, quote, shocked. Prosecutors also discussing what they called the bravery of these victims who came forward.
To the victims in this case, your voices were heard and justice was finally served. This conviction would not have been possible without the bravery and resilience of R. Kelly's victims.
That is a view of the prosecutor. They, of course, have a perspective on the case, but we want to make sure you understand it's really rooted in facts and testimonial evidence, because this exhaustive trial featured often heartbreaking testimony from 45 witnesses, the jury deliberating 9 hours before deciding to convict what is now obviously a quite disgraced superstar singer. This is not the first time that Kelly has been on trial. He was actually acquitted of related child pornography charges back in 2008. That's an update on a significant case there. We're going to fit in a break, but when we come back, as promised, the legendary journalist Bob Woodward is my special guest on The Beat tonight. We're going to get into his new reporting and the future of the Republican Party in a time where Trump makes Nixon look, well, like a lot better than he looked at the time. But first, we have a twist in the Matt Gaetz sex crime probe with that and Bob Woodward coming up tonight on The Beat. Republican Congressman and MAGA favorite Matt Gaetz getting ready for a legal fight. He has been widely reported, been under criminal investigation for sex trafficking and sex with a minor. He denies all wrongdoing and has been very loud about it, at least when he's not under oath.
It is a horrible allegation, and it is a lie.
I've spent my entire career pursuing justice. I don't obstruct justice. The only thing I've obstructed is the injustice, oftentimes at the hands of the Department of Justice.
So the things the media has said about me are lies, and the truth will prevail.
Are you concerned you'll be indicted?
No.
Mr. Gaetz has seen those media appearances change shape as he hasn't been on Fox News in a long time, ever since a bizarre interview with Tucker Carlson. So that's the public front. But behind closed doors, there are some other clues. Gaetz, who said he expects this whole thing to basically go away, has been tapping a high-profile defense team that includes Mark Mukasey, a very popular veteran of the Bush administration, and a New York attorney who actually repped Jeffrey Epstein and El Chapo. Both of these are popular figures on the right, and they are lawyers with a lot of experience in tricky situations. Meanwhile, Gates' associate Joel Greenberg pleaded guilty to six federal crimes that include sex trafficking. He has been cooperating. The Daily Beast has reporting now that legal experts say the move here on the staffing front suggests that Gates may be bracing for some kind of, quote, extremely grave and complex defense, or that he's ready to go scorched earth in his approach against the DOJ. Now, to be clear, all of this is interpretation. At this juncture, Gates is clearly hiring up a team, but has not been hit with any charges that they would yet defend. We will keep an eye on any further developments on that case. Now, when we come back, an interview that you can probably tell I am looking forward to. We're going to get into the state of the nation, what we can learn from the past 4 years as we move ahead, with the one and only investigative reporter, a titan of Washington, Bob Woodward, live on the beat next.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
Breaking news. The chairman of the January 6th Select Committee has just stepped out and revealed the news of more subpoenas.
Are you sending additional subpoenas?
Yes.
But can you tell us who those went out to?
I'll tell you tomorrow.
Why don't you tell us now? We won't tell anybody.
I know. Right. Okay.
Yeah. How can you tell us how many you sent?
That will benefit states like you. It'll be a good number.
As Chairman Thompson there, that broke just this hour. We just got the tape into our newsroom, and he is saying there, you can hear him through the mask, that there are new subpoenas coming. He made it sound like there would be many. He wouldn't name the names, stating that the process would include that revelation tomorrow. All of this comes after the subpoenas of other top Trump advisors and White House officials. It's all about accountability for January 6th and beyond. There was a similar push after Watergate and Richard Nixon's many abuses of power. Congressional investigations that picked up where journalistic investigations may have began, and then that led to new laws and reforms to try to prevent the very corruption and the meddling in the Justice Department and other things exposed during that period. Now, we've not seen Congress come together and pass a similar wave yet, but we keep learning many new things about Trump's last days in office, what the insurrection brought, and just what was the thinking inside the White House. The danger here is what will happen in the next set of elections, especially if, as we've been covering, there are different people in charge. We have, we think, one of the best guests you could get anywhere in the country for this right now, the iconic journalist Bob Woodward. His reporting, of course, exposed the Watergate scandal and has deepened public understanding of many historic developments in many presidencies. The latest book by Mr. Woodward, Peril, that he co-authored, produces many revelations with Robert Costa, ranging from Trump's tenure to his last days in office to just how we got to an insurrection in America. Good to see you again, sir. Thanks for coming back on the beat.
Thank you.
Part of what Congress is doing is trying to use the power of law and subpoena to get interviews that you somehow often get without that great power, sir. And that's what journalists do. They are trying to get some Trump officials to talk to them that, according to the book, you've already spoken with. And so what did you learn? What should we understand about the facts leading up to January 6th and the mentality inside that White House?
Well, the overall mentality here is Trump's claim that the election was stolen. One of the things Bob Costa and I found, there were memos, and as you know, is a legal matter when you have documentation of memos Rudy Giuliani sent to Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and a memo that White House lawyer John Eastman sent to Senator Mike Lee of Utah. Two of the most conservative pro-Trump Republicans in the Senate and perhaps in the country. And so they looked at the allegations of stolen election, and they concluded across the board there was zero evidence to support this. So if you look at it, if you had a presentation to a jury of 12 Americans, they would look at this and they might have political feelings pro-Trump or anti-Trump, but the documentation is so solid in the investigations and the conclusions of Trump's friends. Just this week, then Trump denounced Senators Graham and Senators Lee, saying that they gave up and that they should be embarrassed for abandoning his stolen election claim. But if you look at it in through a neutral lens, and given the political schism in this country, it's hard, but that's what Costa and I were able to do. And it's clear there is no evidence of the stolen election. What Trump has done since he left office, he's almost basing his rationale for a candidacy in 2024 is, well, they stole it from me in 2020, so maybe as a consolation prize or his view of justice, they should give it to him in 2024. But that's not what the presidency is about.
Yeah, you got that right. You mentioned the lawyers, Bob. You have this scene that you detail, and it seems like quite intrepid, interesting reporting, where it's after Trump has lost, it's after the appeals have gone nowhere, and you write that then Attorney General Barr told him, look, you could have gotten a great team of crackerjack lawyers, but instead you have a clown car of people like Giuliani. Now, first of all, I find that interesting because Barr shouldn't even really be giving much of that kind of advice. It's verging on improper for the attorney general because he's not, of course, the lawyer to the president. But second, you seem to capture a type of candor behind the scenes that was surely different from the way Mr. Barr conducted himself, at least publicly, as a very, very supportive attorney general, backing up almost anything Donald Trump said. I know you just report what you found, but can you enlighten us any more about why you included that in the book? What does it tell us? Do you believe that that was Mr. Barr trying to look good now, or what was that about?
No, I think it's true. Look, Barr, a supporter of Trump, somebody who wanted him to be reelected, went in private to President Trump last year during the campaign and said, look, I travel the country as much as any of your cabinet officers. I see your supporters. You have them. But, Mr. President, they basically think you are an effing a-hole. And you have to notch it down. When Trump said, well, why don't you look at these stolen election claims, what was very important, Barr said, look, in the Justice Department, they said we shouldn't do this. I took it, this is Barr talking, an extra important step and had five U.S. attorneys in the states that were allegedly contested look at this. And Barr said to Trump, Mr. President, there is nothing. There is absolutely nothing here. We looked at it. So you've got all of these people who are supporters of Trump, want him reelected, saying you are basing this premise of the stolen election on nothing. Like as we saw in Arizona, they spent a long time and lots of money counting the votes again, and Biden actually got more votes. Costa and I spent time emptying the pockets and minds of people involved in this because, you know, maybe there is something. Maybe there was some sort of fraud. We found absolutely zero.
Does your reporting leave you with the impression that Trump is likely to run again or not?
Yes. We think there's abundant evidence that he's going to run again. You know the polling. He has a lock in the Republican Party, at least for the moment. You and I know each other well enough. I'm not a partisan in this. If we found something that supported Trump, we would put it in the book. In the book, we give Trump credit for pushing on the vaccine. It's something that Joe Biden won't do, really. Trump did push on the vaccine. It was successful. Again, you have to look at what the facts are. But we, as you so well know, live in this toxic environment of the schism. You're either for Trump or you're against Trump. And I think it's important. Look, you understand law, and law and facts actually in a courtroom, and our political system is not a courtroom, but it should approximate it. And I would argue, if you look at this, this is something that's got to be alarming to a Trump supporter. Wait a minute, who's got evidence? Former Attorney General Barr, zero. Lindsey Graham, zero. Mike Lee, Senator from Utah, very conservative, somebody who talked to Trump about this. And again, another zero evidence.
Mm. Yeah, and as you say, you do that reporting so you hear from those people, and that helps underscore whether this was a march to find a solution or a solution that was just pressed down regardless. The final question I have for you is just, what do you say to people who look at these books and say, well, the sources are giving a lot of the direction, and there are people like Barr or Miley who seem to want to make sure people know that they were somehow more secretly critical than it seemed. We're all familiar with that type of analysis, but what give you the benefit of responding to that?
Well, in the case of General Milley, he was very public about pushing back from Trump. So that's no surprise. That was not concealed. He's testifying tomorrow, and it's going to be very interesting because Bob Costa and I found no evidence that he committed treason, as some people allege. In fact, all of the information we have, and we spent months on this, is that he did things to protect the country from Trump, and Trump was doing things, accusing on the pandemic, always talking about the China virus, tweeting that millions of ballots are going to be coming from foreign countries. Donald Trump set the stage of doubt and worry that caused people to say, hey, wait a minute, we, within the procedures and the law, and I think people acted within procedures and the law, we need to make sure that something bad does not happen.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
bad things happen, like war.
No, that's why I wanted to, it was great to have you back on, Bob, as I haven't seen you since COVID hit, at least in person. But we always appreciate your reporting. People know your work. And you are what they would call, as a tribute, old school in getting all the interviews and all the evidence, but new school in keeping up with every breaking story. So we appreciate it, sir.
Old man. Old man, old school. Thank you.
I didn't say old man. I said old school. Good to see you, Bob. And again, let me tell everyone interested, the book is Peril. It's out now. We'll be right back. An update before we go. We showed this news today. The January 6th committee chairman, Thompson, discussing potential new subpoenas this hour. We just got a statement in here at the Beat from his office that says what he was indicating is that more announcements about subpoenas are possible later this week. The latest and greatest, we'll always bring it to you as we get it. That does it for The Beat this hour.